Hi, I'm Jerry Goldstein, and this is Bill Fiss. Welcome to Bill and Jerry's excellent podcast, a.k.a. Spilling the Career Tea. We're really excited today because we're joined by Stephen Bloom. Stephen is a graduate of Yale University, and he's been the Senior Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Association of Yale Alumni since 2011. Steve and I met as part of a People Grove advisory board because we design mentorship programs for our respective universities. Steve started his career at KPMG after graduating Yale. He received his master's in CPA at NYU at night and led KPMG's U.S. Corporate Finance Department. Then you moved on to a private investment bank where Steve was managing director, eventually chief operating officer, before returning to Yale. So we have a wealth of knowledge here that we're very excited about. Steve loves books, traveling, racket sports, outdoor activities. And the thing that I think we have the most in common is that you have 5 fencing championships as the captain of the Yale fencing team. I, likewise, am building a fence, and I thought maybe you could be helpful. We could collaborate.
Questionable overlap.
Okay, well then, let's start off. Why don't you tell us about yourself, anything that I missed?
Sure, let me do that. Well, but I want to add that you mentioned I returned to Yale, and this is relevant to our discussion. I feel like I never left, right?
Right.
So I took a 36-year leave of absence, but I'm back here on campus.
That's
now.
Awesome.
What I would add, and it's a great privilege at my point in my career, is that for the last 13 years, I've lived with students at Yale as a resident fellow in one of Yale's colleges. And that provides just priceless insight. It's not just the insight of providing wisdom. It's also the fact that I learn a lot from the students that I live with.
Great.
That's awesome. This journey is fascinating, right? And it expands, you know, decades as you referenced. Tell us a little bit more about the sequencing and
sure.
How much of it was planned, how much of it
yeah.
extemporaneous, et cetera.
Yeah. There are a couple of elephants on the stage, right?
Yeah.
Which is there were 2 big career pivots for me. One was leaving KPMG, where I had had a very exciting and satisfying career. And then the other was coming to Yale. And that obviously can provide insight to, I think, many people in your audience is how does that happen? And I'm going to be very candid along the way. This is a micro alert. At KPMG, things went very well for me. I progressed quickly. I became a partner there 7 years after I joined. And I got to do, as you said, build a couple of practices there, our business valuation practice and also our corporate finance practice. And to some extent, and I'm being, again, very candid, I read my own press a little bit, and when things go well, sometimes you put one foot in front of the other and just keep doing it. And there probably was a point in time where I should have been more intentional about thinking what should come next. Mm. There's a concept which I suspect you plan to talk with me about, which I'm going to bring up now, which is called ikigai. It's a Japanese term, and in fact, it is the quest that we should all have for finding this intersection between what we love, what we do well, and what the world needs. And during my time at KPMG, I was doing something that I think I did well. It was exciting. I learned from it. I'm not sure that it was something that I was truly passionate about. And ultimately, I found my way. So the first big pivot, that elephant on the stage, was moving from KPMG to Burnham Securities, where I did spend time for most of the next decade. And that decision really was one where I finally had a manager with whom I didn't have perfect chemistry at KPMG. Hmm. And I think that sort of motivated me to think about what came next. But notice that's a little bit reactive, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I'd been a little more intentional about that process. Moving from Burnham to Yale, that's a big move. Hmm. Here's a guy with an undergraduate degree in economics, graduate degree from Stern, as you pointed out, in accounting. And now I'm going to higher ed? How does that happen? And a lot of people in my life, I guess you could say my mentors, my peers, my family and friends, encouraged me to think about Yale and where Yale was in my life. And I had been active, as you point out, as a fencer. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I had gone there as a student. I had two children who happened to have gone there. Mm-hmm. I had important roles as an alumni volunteer. And people said, well, wait a minute, maybe you could actually work there. And so it took a little pushing, and ultimately it landed me in that third phase. So those two big pivots revealed that maybe I wasn't as intentional as people should be, and we should all encourage our audience to think about things more intentionally.
Do you have to think intentionally, right? This is, we've discussed this to some extent, or some of it just sort of flows, right?
You're making a good point. If you're not going to, I think it might have been Eisenhower had said during the, you know, World War II, something like, it's not the strategic plan, it's the planning.
Yeah.
And a little bit, it's sort
both
of
end.
Thinking about things, it's being open to what could happen next.
Yeah.
And yes, I think I probably was at the appropriate times open to what was coming next.
Yeah. Help me understand a little bit more, and for the audience, your role today.
Yeah.
What does it constitute? What are the interactions? You've been there and really impacting for a bit, right? So who are your constituents? Who are your clients? What's your strategic focus
right. To
help the folks at Yale?
No, that's
and
great.
Your alum,
a great question. Yeah. Thank you for that. My role at Yale is, as it now turns out, to build community. And I do that in a couple of ways with my team. One is we launched PeopleGrove, which is a vendor that provides community building platforms. And I know that there are other schools that you discussed that have used PeopleGrove. And I helped launch our PeopleGrove platform, which we call Cross Campus, a little over 5 years ago. And this helped us build our One Yale concept at Yale, building community closer. Mm. We did that in particular, and we're still doing it, with two major cohorts. And those cohorts are alumni and students. Roughly 23,000 alums have joined Cross Campus and 7,000 students.
Wow.
So we've scaled. A year later, we realized that even though we had this vibrant platform that was growing quickly post-pandemic, that we could do it even better by launching intentional mentorship on top of that platform. So we now have three cross-campus mentorship programs. So one of my other roles, and I consider it maybe the most important thing I'm doing right now, is to pair alums as mentors with either undergraduates or graduate students or other alums as mentees. And believe it or not, we've now made 16,500 pairings since we launched these programs. Every semester we pair between 1,500 and 1,800 Yalies with a mentor. So those are the most important things I do. I also do manage programs at Yale that provide the opportunity for alums to trade wisdom with other alums and with students.
I want to probe on that a little bit, because I think that is, I don't know where else it happens, I'm sure it does, the alum to alum segment of that. We've talked at length, and everybody understands, a student to a well-intended alum, and that partnership pays a lot of dividends to student. I wonder, how did Yale or you figure out that maybe even more important, depending on that extended relationship, is the alum to alum to keep, what was the term you used? You know, it's Yale forever or whatever,
yeah.
Right? Yeah.
One Yale.
One Yale. Go ahead.
Right. No, it's a great question. And even backing up a step, when you have a community building platform, like in our case, Cross Campus, provided by PeopleGrove, when you have that, you have a population that skews younger. We all know why.
Yeah.
You're more likely to be in an online community like that when you're more recently out of Yale or still in Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, these mentorship programs help us create meaning for the students because they get wisdom from the alumni cohort. It also, of course, provides engagement for the alums who may not be in a point in their life where they can give back money, but they can give back wisdom.
Yes.
They're forming a family. They can't necessarily travel, but they can help. I'm leading to your point, though.
Yeah.
So a natural progression from that is to have what we call A to A or alum to alum mentorship.
Mm-hmm.
And the alums that need the mentorship, they could conceivably be 50 or 60 years old, but most of the time they're between 20 and 40 years old. And this is another way of engaging a group of alums that all of us whether it's Fordham, whether it's Miami, whether it's Yale,
yes.
We all need to create forms of engagement for alums that are fairly recent so that they stay attached to the university forever.
I think that's a huge objective, right? Because I don't want to put it in dollars and cents, but the obvious next step of when you feel engaged, maybe you're a 50-year-old alum who got laid off, mm-hmm. and now they have to turn, who knows, maybe for the first time in their career, mm-hmm. and where are they going? To another alum that might be able to open up a door? Mm-hmm. The impact of that to the engagement office or the development office at whatever school mm-hmm. is obvious.
Yeah, and there are, in a way, we can migrate this a little bit toward the types of mentorships that people need. You know, as they progress along in life and now they're outside of our various universities and their recent alums, let's say, they still need career insights. They also need somebody who can hold a mirror up to them and remind them who they are at this point in their life. Mm-hmm. So those needs continue. They may not need as much sort of the resume review that perhaps a student needs, but they do have these other needs.
Well, maybe the point you made about lacking intentionality during your career makes you more able to realize that now and help more people because you maybe didn't have that mirror held up.
Yes, I think that's true. I did have mentors, you know, along the way. My mother and father were incredible sources of inspiration for me, and I had early supporters at KPMG that certainly helped. When you don't necessarily have somebody who consciously holds up that mirror, or perhaps you forget to ask her or him to do that for you, strangely enough, there can be other things in your life that help you. And some of them can be crises.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So again, this is a micro alert that I'm going to be candid with you. I have been divorced twice. And leaving a marriage forces you to look at yourself and think about who you are and what you can accomplish. So it doesn't have to be quite that dramatic in the lives of your audience, but when you have something that's a challenge for you, that can be an opportunity for you to see yourself better.
Absolutely. Well said. In our pre-interview, just to pivot just a little bit, you said something like, as much as you want to know, I'm paraphrasing, what you do like, you need to know what you don't like.
Yeah.
Expand, what does that mean?
Sure.
Other than the obvious.
One of our alums, we have sort of many very interesting alums. One of them is Anderson Cooper, who many of us have seen on CNN.
Front and center.
And he came back and talked with our students a few years ago. And when he did, one thing that stuck with me, he talked about his early career. And even a guy like him, you know, we all stumble. And he talked about the importance of understanding early in your career that part of it is about learning what you don't like. What city don't you like? What corporate culture don't you like? What kind of manager don't you like? What kind of work don't you like? And, you know, sometimes we get hung up trying to have the perfect first job. Actually, the first and the second job may be a great opportunity to have the perfect third job.
Sure. Yeah, but how, I couldn't agree with you more, but if you're a rising sophomore, junior, whatever, at Yale, and you say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, but how do I know? So what's the advice that some of your mentors might be giving them, you know, to sort of learn through those experiences?
Yeah, there are sort of several different ways that you learn that. One is interacting with your peers. There are, I should back up actually and say, I think there are four cohorts of wisdom that are available to students when they're trying to think these things through. One is their peers. That challenge can be that their peers themselves are early enough in their lives, they may not have all that wisdom. A second could be family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we worry a little bit that our family and friends might have an angle. And
too much influence.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And then the third would be the faculty and employees of the higher ed institution we're with. I think that's a great source of wisdom, although now that I'm working at Yale, of course, we're all in a certain kind of bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And so there can be some limitation to that. And then the fourth cohort is alums.
Yeah.
And the alums at various points in their lives can provide that kind of wisdom that, that can help narrow things down.
Yeah. What are you seeing that's different today? It's a tough environment, not even literally today, the last few years, in students at Yale trying to figure it out? Has any, I mean, we went through the COVID years, and we touched on that in a very different episode, and that has not been easy for early career. But what other observations, Steve, around how things are evolving to today's undergrad at Yale or anywhere?
Right. So you almost have to back up and look at the fact that all of our institutions and the institutions with which your audience are part, it's a much more diverse group of people. Mm-hmm. So you have this incredible array of experiences that you're being exposed to. And technology, of course, is also accelerating the rate at which students are being bombarded with possibilities. So where I'm headed with this is there can be a great deal of stress. Mm-hmm. The stress can be caused by the fact that you're hearing so many things in short order. The stress can be caused by the fact that you see these incredible array, this incredible array of people around you that are part of your campus. And there can easily be an imposter syndrome. So there's stress associated with it. I think that's one of the biggest changes, is feeling that. Going back in time, when my kids were at Yale, or even further back when I was at Yale, you didn't plan your internship 1.5 years in advance. And now right. people feel like they need to.
Yeah.
Right. For sure.
Absolutely.
So I want to get back to Ikigai, because...
How do you say it again? Ikigai.
Ikigai.
Japanese. Ikigai.
Am I
Ikigai.
Saying that right?
I think so.
Yeah.
Ikigai.
Well, I'm going to interrupt long enough to say that the irony is that I had been a believer for a long time that it's passion, aptitude, need, these three things. And then I stumbled on the fact about 6 months ago that this was almost synonymous with this term, Ikigai.
Mm-hmm. Ikigai. Also, you said, though, that they'll pay me for it. Is that a piece?
It is
not
a piece. I happen to think it's sort of an outcome of the first three.
All right.
But yes, it's a piece of Ikigai.
Right. So it's funny, because I was talking about in a different episode, college can be used for exploration and figuring out what you want to do, so that when you wake up every morning, you're happy to go to work. You're looking forward to do what you're wanting to do. But you need to figure out what that is. And we got a comment on that clip that was basically, that's BS. Find out what you're good at, lean into it, and do it whether you like it or not. Mm-hmm. So with that conflict in theories, I think I would go with Ikigai personally. But how do you justify that with the parent who's paying for their child to get an education so they can get off the payroll and create their own life, and obviously parents focus on support and what you're going to be able to do to take care of yourself. How do you reconcile that?
So there's no denying that there's a tension between this pressure that we discussed 5 minutes ago that exists for students, and the fact that when you're on campus for, let's say, 4 years as an undergrad, you have a chance to take risks with and relationship risks and thinking risks with less consequence, which is great. And so it is a tension that this is there. And when you think about possibilities, I, as a parent, I'm influenced by the fact that both of my children, who are now in their late 30s, actually one just turned 40, I can't believe that, they majored in music. It happens that both of them are now software engineers.
Amazing.
And these things are possibilities. And so I never lose sight of that. I want to sort of put a wrap on this question you've asked, which is to say, you build relationships on campus because you have this incredible convenience of people being nearby. And at the same time, you're taught critical thinking. And you can have that critical thinking and that problem solving happen in almost any sort of major. So I'm just a great believer that, we shouldn't get too hung up vocationally on what we have to major in. It's more building those relationships and understanding how to think right.
Very interesting.
Right. I think, a lot of what we experience at Fordham is that arts and humanities suffers because they don't really have a mapped out direction in which they know what their career can look like. But I try and help people realize that you can have almost any career. I mean, you can't be a surgeon unless you go to medical school, but you can have a very successful career in a lot of different ways as long as you're creating a skill base where you can use the knowledge that you're gaining in college and use your education in a way that provides value.
That's right.
You know, I want to probe on that at Yale for a minute and ask, right? A lot of schools are known for a lot of different things. Yale obviously has a fantastic brand, reputation, Ivy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whether you're a research university, you know, whether you're academically at the top of the list, et cetera. And back to the reference of parents today, right? What do they really want? So you could have academic advising while you're there and take this, do that, switch to that. But I wonder if this is true at Yale or how you were able to get it to be a focus. And that is, you know what? We should be spending equal, if not more, time in the sets of things we want to work on at Yale or be distinguished about around what happens when they get out. So is that prevalent today at Yale? And was it always? Or you've been front and center in it for a while. I guess what I'm saying in short stroke is not all universities have this on their radar screen.
Right. We are in the midst of doing a series of listening sessions with our alums in lieu of a full alumni survey, and we feel we'll get more intimate feedback. But one of the there are four emerging pillars, if you will, of perceived needs that alumni see, and I think this provides a clue on your question. One is friendship and networking. Another is lifelong learning, which would apply over a period of many decades. A third one is service, but I'm leading to a point that you're bringing up. And the fourth pillar is professional development and mentorship. And consider that as one pillar. And that's where I live at Yale right now. And I think our university is very consciously addressing that need, which is a lifelong need. It's a need on campus and it's a need afterwards.
Yeah. Do you think it's a trend? I mean, I don't know if you know or think or hope that it is a developing trend at universities that are so distinguished and known for some other things that it costs, you know, I don't know what it is, it's over $100,000 to put a student to school these days, right?
There are, of course, substantial subsidies depending on family income.
Yes.
The full price sticker tag is high, without a doubt, and that does put pressure on this question of how you build the skills, both personal skills and professional skills. Yeah. Yes, I do think that it is more and more important for schools to be addressing this. I think they are.
Yeah.
I know I've mentioned more than once now the People Growth Platform, and this is one of the ways it reveals itself.
Yeah, and I think, do you agree? I think schools are beginning to discover that, or they do?
Well, schools like Yale and what Steve and I
are
doing.
There are some distinguished schools, right?
Right, Fordham, Yale. We're, Steve and I know each other because we're sort of at the forefront of what this should be looking like.
Right.
And we work with many partners, but People Growth gives us the ability to create software not only for mentorship and networking, but we're adding components right now for experiential learning, lifelong learning, career assessment, things that we can start with incoming freshmen, and you can stay on that platform and use the tools for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's where everything is going, and we may be 18 months or 2 years ahead of the curve, but that's where it's all going to end up.
Going to bring it back to mentorship in two ways, just because I think it's important to make this point. One is it really is important to know that one does need more than one mentor at a time. One also will almost surely need different mentors over time. It's that rare situation where You can have the same person decade after decade. So whether you have a platform that helps you bind the community together or not, being aware of that and making it possible is really important. The other thing is we all need to acknowledge that the generation that's on campus and recently off campus, just having graduated, their affiliations have rebalanced a little bit versus people who are older. They don't automatically attach to the institution. They attach to each other, to their friends and cohorts. And having a community that allows them to find each other, that almost disintermediates the institution a little bit, that's a good thing in the long run because it creates engagement.
Well, we wouldn't have found each other if we didn't both go to the University of Miami.
Yeah.
We weren't there at the same time.
Yeah.
Right? And I think some of the people that we know today, we certainly wouldn't have known unless we were connected and we're meeting people every day through Miami's People Growth platform.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think you're 100% correct. And that's just where it's going.
Right.
That's what school has to be now.
Right. But, you know, not everybody, you've said, and you had sons go as legacy, right? Not everybody thinks about, I'm very passionate about my alma mater, you are, we know that, right?
Right.
Not everybody is there. And some of this, to tie it together, might be because of some of the gaps. So what if they, you know, during my time there, great. But why am I connected there now? What has Miami, Yale, or Fordham done for me lately? And I think that we already touched on this. When you can provide value, whatever that means to you, you can say survey, you know, what are the most important things to keep that engagement front and center?
Well, listen, you know my pet peeve is when I ask someone, why are we doing this? And they say, because it would be cool. You know, that's not an answer you want to give me when I'm trying to get something done.
Yeah.
The answer is because we can create value, right? And I started on this journey with you because I was running the University of Miami New York Alumni Association.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I realized very quickly we had to give value. And the value that was the most sought after was career services.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how I made the pivot from practicing law to what I'm doing now.
Which is a passion, right? Sounds like similar to you.
I will slightly tweak that to say absolutely the career, but I would also add the word wisdom.
Yes.
Career and life wisdom.
Mm.
And this is something where, again, the alumni cohort can come to the rescue and really add value.
That's right.
Steve, I'm going to ask you as we're going to pivot here with a student in a couple of minutes, and we'll bring you back for that next episode. But of all the things going on now, as we've touched on, or maybe we haven't touched on, is there another trend or two or observation you would like to share around what's happening today as you're in your role and you're seeing the dynamic of what's involved and what's happening in front of us?
I'm going to redirect that question toward, you know, if there's just one or two things that I hope that people will realize when they're still on campus as students. One is they're never going to have another opportunity to spend 4 years in such close quarters with people who can provide such value to them that goes beyond the classroom. It'll never happen again unless they accidentally happen to immediately be employed by that educational institution. So one is that. Another is, again, as I mentioned before, the opportunity to take risk with only modest consequences on the downside.
Fair.
And later in life, you know, you really do have to be somewhat intentional about what you do. But on campus, you can try things. So these are two important pieces of advice.
Well, I
know it's not a trend. It's just,
right.
And I guess to address, you know, embedded in your question is, there is tension now.
Right.
There's a lot of
competition.
It's tough to get into school. It's tough to get into jobs afterwards. It's to make sure you're also looking inward, not just sideways at what other people are doing. Understand who you are. Figure out self-assessment and mindset management.
That's great advice.
Said. Yeah.
Maybe that's a future episode.
Yeah. Self-assessment.
And mindset management.
Well,
and one follows the other.
I definitely don't think one episode is enough to have with Steve. we'll maybe bring you back to discuss that. But we would like to bring in a student. If you join us and head over to the roundtable,
that would be wonderful.
Where's the roundtable? Where is it?
We'll find it, and we'll do Spilling the Mentee.
That sounds great. Okay. And Jerry and Bill, it's already been a privilege. Thank you for
thank you.
Me.
No, the pleasure is ours, and thank you, Steve. And we'll expand on some of these concepts.
We'll spill more career tea.
Right.
Great.
So, with a very deserving student.
Absolutely. So
where are they going to find this? I always ask.
Join us on the 1st and the 15th of every month when we drop our episodes. You can find us on YouTube under Bill and Jerry's Excellent Podcast, a.k.a. Spilling the Career Tea. We have a website, spillingthecareertea.com. We're on all major social media platforms under Spilling the Career Tea. You can find the podcast audio version on Spotify, Apple, and wherever you listen to podcasts. So we're going to move over to the roundtable for a new episode. Thank you so much, Steve. We're glad you're going to join us. We're definitely having you back. I can say that without
absolutely,
consulting with you.
Absolutely.
Just one episode is not enough with you. But for now, thanks, everybody, and we'll see you in our next episode.